So that this apparently simple process of just coming, getting present, coming into your senses, and becoming the bridge, facing both ways, is the absolute heart of all this work. There's lots of other methods that help and you know, our support structures. But this, in a way, is the fundamental. This is the fundamental method where we are bringing the worlds together. And in a certain sense, having to hold all kinds of opposites when we do that, but holding it from a kind of a bigger field inside ourselves, because actually as we do that, our identity deepens. Because there's something then about we're not just skittering about on the surface of the world, we are also beings of the depths. And so there's a part of us that is like a great whale that can go right down into the depths, that can go right up to the surface. And the in a way, it's expanding. Part of the work that happens in this work is the part of the disarrangement that happens is that we aren't who we think we are. You know, there's parts of ourselves that are very known to ourselves. You know, particularly when we get to the age of some of us, we are very known. But there is a much greater unknownness, in a way, which is what we start to encounter as we move down into the depths. And in a way, one of the really, you know, useful ways I have of understanding that this process, for me anyway, is a bit like this process of wading from the beach into the sea. You know, in a sense, the part of me that's at home on dry land is very much, nothing wrong with dry land, you need dry land, you need solidity, so it's not to reject solidity, we need it. But it's only part of our experience. So the other part is of me is the beach and the various levels of the sea. But I've become, in a way, I suppose, comfortable with myself as a dry land mammal. In a way, I know how to do all that. It's very known, it's very shaped, all kinds of ways of operating in it. But when I start to come into a different element, then there's a whole number of processes that I have to go through and keep going through in order to become more and more comfortable at being in both places. You know, the very first level, for example, that even in the dry land, there is a need for wetness. So fluidity is, you know, the human body is partly solid, partly fluid. So even in the driest of places, even in the most solid of places, there's a constant need for wetness. So that depth, that is that metaphor, that depth, that deeper place, even in the most surface aspect of ourself, is irrigated by something. Otherwise, it cannot live. The completely dry, completely solid, is dead. So there's something. So the very beginning of a process like this is to discover, if you like, the fluidity, the wetness within the most solid aspect of ourselves. Those of us who are therapists really know about that, because people come to see us when their solidity is disrupted by things that are not about any, in their term, not about any direct experience of the depth, but about something coming in that's rearranging things. And in a way, this is a bit like that kind of, you know, the rivers that run through the land. There's a constant irrigation going on and rain falling on the land. So there's a constant interplay between the depths and the surface, you know. And you know, literally, the sun evaporates water from the sea, water vapor rises, turns into clouds, falls down on us as rain. You know, so there's a constant, that deep place and the high place are constantly, or surface place, are constantly in relationship. They are one ecosystem. But in the way that we have learned to be, we've created, and most of us have created, a separation between that deeper, more fluid place and the place that is dry and solid. And so it can feel, that other aspect of ourselves can feel alien or not us. And I suppose the very first places, I suppose, that you find this other part is in, sometimes when you're doing things that you really enjoy. Music, art, activity, something that gets us into a relaxed state and causes us to have an experience of flow. It could be a rock concert, could be listening to a favorite composer, it could be going for a nice walk. It's that place where something in us relaxes and we start to become more open to the unknown. So that's just like the very beginning somewhere almost. I mean, that's like discovering, in my metaphor of the beach and the ocean, it's a bit like discovering a nice rock pool where we can kind of get a bit interested and fascinated by this unfamiliar element, strange element. But it's contained enough for us to be able to touch it and wet ourselves in. But we're never going to be out of our depth in that somewhere. You know, it's a sort of contained place, and there's nothing wrong with that. It's the beginning of understanding a different element. But the real change happens, in a sense, when we decide to move our, if you like, our locus, the place where we live, our dwelling place, more into the other element. And that is equivalent to deciding to take a step on into the place where the tide comes in, to get our feet wet. In a way, that's making a decision to, I want to get my feet wet, I want to experience this other element. I want to discover what it's like to touch this fluid, flowing, in and out process, this tidal process somewhere that feels very different from the solid known world that I normally live in. There's something attractive about it. There's something that calls me. And in a way, in the metaphor, of course, the sea is deeply related to the moon. In one side, we've got like the sort of the driest land with the sun. We've got the sea and the moon. The tides, of course, are controlled by the moon. So in a sense, we've got this movement into the different side of our nature. We could say more into our lunar as opposed to our solar nature. You know, so there's something about this world that's fluid, that is shifting all the time. You know, the sun is a constant presence. It comes up, it goes down, it comes up, it goes down. The moon waxes and wanes constantly. So already, if we start to relate to the moon and the sea and the tides, we're starting to relate to a really kind of different quality of energy. We're moving into fluidity, into mystery, into growth and decay. You know, that is constantly moving. So we have to become attentive in a different way. You know, in a sense, we have to learn to follow hints, learn to feel into faint, imperceptible processes that, if we follow them, become stronger. They wax and they come to the full, and then they start to wane again. So there's a sort of a different relationship, really, to the energies of life and to our own energies. Now, coming back to the metaphor of wading again, one of the things that starts to happen as you start to wade into the ground becomes less solid, because of course the earth and the sand are mixing together, and because of this fluidic motion, this coming in, going out motion, you have this tidal movement where the tide comes rushing in, and there's a sort of movement of fullness, and then there's a pulling out into the deep, and a sucking back. So we have to still, and in order not to fall over, we have to, normally speaking, have to lower our center of gravity. You have to just slightly bend your knees, come down a bit, become actually more grounded in the fluid world that we're standing in. Paradox, but it's literally true. If you do, you stand on a beach and do that, you have to go lower down. And when you learn to do that, you can just learn to do that. You can walk, you can wade just for quite a distance out into the sea. You have to be very attentive to what's underneath your feet because you can't see it that clearly. So your attention has to be down. You have to be down into your feet, down into the lower part of your body. But you can wade quite a long way out, really. And in that process, increasingly, you can get used to that tidal kind of movement. But there's a point at which that doesn't work anymore, where the kind of natural buoyancy of the body means you can't keep your feet on the ground. And in a certain sense, you can say, in a metaphor, you can't ground yourself in the old way there. Because this is the moment where you have to, this is the moment where you start, where you literally are getting out of your known depth. And you have to make a 180 degree movement turn. Instead of standing up, you have to lie down.
90 degrees.
You're right. 180 degrees. 180 degrees would have you standing on your head, wouldn't it? Yeah. Yeah. Thank you. That's, which wouldn't go very well in this metaphor, actually, because you'd probably die, wouldn't you? Okay. Good plan. So 90 degree movement. Thank you very much. So you come basically to floating, and now. As describing yesterday, my own attempts to float. This is difficult because you have to really give yourself into another element. So, in terms of a metaphor here, in a sense, there's a way in which, as we kind of work with the unknown, we work with the imagination. There's a way in which we ground ourselves in it. It becomes part of us. It becomes a known part of us. We learn methods of working with it and remaining grounded in it. But then there's a move. Then there's this deeper movement where we have to. We have to learn by giving ourselves into that imaginal sea. We have to learn to start to become part of that element. Which means we have to treat it not as something that we can just use or we can walk in. We have to become a part of it. We have to learn its ways, not acclimatize it to our ways. And the very first thing that we need to do is to relax into it. Now, when we come into the senses, when we bring the senses together, when we bridge in between, when we really start to let ourselves sink, that's the moment where we're having to learn to float. Right, so that we have to kind of, because in order to do that, you let go into that other more mysterious element. And sometimes we do it, and sometimes we can't do it, but that's the continual kind of practice. Coming into your senses, experiencing the outer world with your senses, letting the senses look inward, feeling the interplay of that. And all this is a bit like wading in the sea. And then there's a moment where if you're going to go deeper, something in you has to kind of let go. Into the intention of the descent. And so that's the moment where you have to, okay, just give yourself into what's happening. And then you have to let that deeper place take you. Then you kind of have to let, then you're moved by the tides. And you may be carried far out, you may be carried, you may not go very far, depends on what time of the year you are normally, where the tide is. Is it coming in? Is it going out? There's a sort of different overall movement. Although the very motion of the tide is in and out all the time. Much in, out, in, out. And that kind of is the motion, right? So when we do this, it's sort of, I mean, sometimes, you know, when people write about these things, it's very linear, right? You go down, you do. But mostly it's a movement of up and down, gradually, up and down, something comes from the outside, you go right up, then you sink down again, and it's trusting, it's kind of learning to trust that kind of motion. And in that process, learning about being in the new element, learning about that deeper part of yourself, and discovering what it's like to float. And you know, one of the things you discover about floating is that you do float. You learn how to float. So you can relax, so you don't panic so much. Because if you don't panic, you can drift further. You can allow the movement. And obviously there's a way in which you have to be attentive to the outer as well. So, and this is true, you know, literally true if you are letting yourself float. If you start to float too far out, you might not be able to get back again. So it's not a motion of letting go of the dry land. The surface place is always there. So you're not required to lose contact with the outer sense of yourself sitting in this room if you're doing it here. There's a sort of subliminal sense of that always. And so if you need to, if you feel out of your depth or something happens that's frightening, you can just go up, return to yourself, your known sense of body and world, and come back into safety again. And when you feel ready, then you can set out again. But there's another place, the next place that we need in some ways, if we're going to go more deeply, is we have to learn to move. So there's a passive being with, passive floating, but then there's the next moment is active engagement. So it's about, you know, learning to swim. And the equivalent here really is working with intention, letting the will kind of direct the inner energy. So it's the equivalent of, instead of just going in, I'm going to hang out here and be in it and learn about it, but being out, there's a sort of, I have a question, I have an issue, I have something that I'm being with, something I want to explore. So I hold that intention. And then as I come into my senses and I come into the scent, I have to learn a way of relaxing while holding that intention. That intention, it's a bit like an arrow. If I hold it too tightly, nothing happens because the flow stops and there's no fluidity. If I don't hold it at all, I lose my focus and I just go off into the inner sea and I never get to where I needed to get to. So there's a sort of an art really of learning to kind of focus my intentionality. So that it's not too loose, not too tight. And it's a bit like, and in a way this is a bit where your sort of shape starts to shift a bit. It is like you become a fish or something, because in order to really, really kind of swim, you have to have that sense of altered form. Your form has to become more streamlined. You have to have a way of propelling yourself without creating too much back current. When you learn to swim, if you remember learning to swim, because of the fear, most of your effort gets a bit wasted because you splash a lot. And the splashing is a lot of wasted energy. You're very tired quite quickly normally because you sort of, and you create a lot of turbulence in the water around you. And the problem with turbulence is that you could drown yourself. You kind of splash it in your mouth. You create kind of cross currents that whack you a bit, and it's certainly a great waste of energy, most of it. When you really do learn to swim, it's a smooth movement with that uses the minimum amount of energy and disturbs the water as little as possible. And the energy is pushed backwards. So all the kind of, so you're not wanting energy bouncing backwards, which might deflect you. It's all gonna help you to move in the direction that you're going in. And you know, one of the reasons why the bards in particular often use this image of the salmon of wisdom is that the salmon, of course, can, like all fish, can go up and can ascend and descend, but it's also the salmon are the preeminent swimmers. They're just extraordinary. They swim right into the ocean. They can go right into the deeps of the ocean. They can go right back to the spawning ground in the middle of the land. So these are consummate swimmers, and in a way, the bards are this is why the salmon of wisdom is a great image for this practice, in a sense. The fish, the salmon of wisdom as well, doesn't need to surface, because of course it can breathe the water. It is completely at home in the water. So there's a certain sense that as we learn to operate in these deeper places, our sense of identity shifts so that we become more a being who can live comfortably in this mysterious place, but who can and therefore you have a sense of yourself as a being who is comfortable in those depths. And moving in those depths is natural to you. It's something that so in a certain sense we could say that in the beginning that sense of going in, holding an intention, can feel very clunky. Feels like, yeah, I'm sort of struggling my way in and hoping to get to where I want to go. Whereas in the deeper places, as we've assimilated some of these lessons, it's like the intention alters our shape. So the intention is part of us, so we move into the region we need to be in accordance with our intention. And in these more fluid realms, distance from and nearness to is about similarity. It's about resonance. So if I am interested, for example, in looking at the root of creativity, so if I feel, or if I want to, for example, let's say I want to understand why the bards were creative. I want to know what the ancient bards were doing. So I hold that question. I hold that intention. I feel my body, I feel the world around me, but I feel myself, as I hold it, becoming at one with that question. So if my question is like a sort of superficial mental question, I will touch it only on the surface, because I can only unify with it in my mind. If it's something coming from a deeper place in me, as I become one with that place of inquiry, then my inner shape shifts and becomes one with the question, and therefore I become energetically resonant with what I am looking for. So therefore I become close to what I'm looking for. So I start to become, so if I'm thinking about in creativity, and if I listen, so that becomes, let me just take the simple question, how can I be more creative? So if I'm going to listen to, if I hold that question, first of all, in my mind, but then I listen to that question with my body, with all of my senses, and if something in me responds to that, so that it becomes not just a question of my mind, but a question of my body, question of my senses, and a longing almost really for that. That sense of embodied longing, that becomes part of the lodestone here, the kind of directionality that, and if I relax then with that, then my shape shifts so that I, in a way, start to come into resonance with that part of myself my identity shifts to become that, and then I find I am near, as I go into the depths, the conditions where that question can be responded to. And what I have to do then is just to be one with that, to relax into that somewhere. And then at a certain point, having, if you like, become one, the question and the answer having become one, there's a sort of, as that inquiring energy becomes satisfied, there's a release there. And then automatically you start to rise up to the surface again, because that motive energy, if you like, that energy that's taking you into the depths, has been met in some way. And then you rise with it up to the surface. And in that, both the your identity and your experience changes, because it gets translated into the surface. This is the experience that's behind this thing where you find gold in fairyland and it comes out and it's dry leaves. Because it gets translated. And the big problem of people in the fairy stories is they think the dry leaves are useless. Whereas actually the dry leaves are the fairy gold. Because in order for that, if you like, that question then that you come with to be embodied on the surface, its nature changes. Because it has to come out from one element into the other. So as you come back into your known identity, you come back with that experience of the depth and the answer to the question, which won't be as you experienced in the depth, it will be a translated experience. So that experience we often have of having touched something and, oh God, I can't quite get it now, but whatever you come back with is it. But it's in translated form. Yeah,
back, isn't it?
That's right.
That somehow it never seems
quite. No, it never is. It is connected to that, and so there's always that sort of frustration, because you know something, you've touched something, and you can't bring it back because you're different in that deep place as well, mm-hmm. And the part of you that is on the surface, it can't encompass that, and it's about then just trying to relax into what you do have and trusting that. It's quite tricky, really, that bit.
Can you relate that back to the rage on the underworld at the moment?
Yeah.
Because I've got a strong interpretation of the cauldron at the time.
Yeah, yeah.
And the realisation that we're not living in myth, we're living in the real world. We cannot bring the cauldron back.
No, that's right.
But we can be infused with the contents of the cauldron and bring it back in that form.
Yes, that's right.
And we can revisit the cauldron whenever we want.
Yes, that's right, exactly.
And the light leaper.
Yeah.
I saw as our focus and our intention.
Yes.
Intentionality.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right.
But the certain things that the prisoner didn't want. He said, "I'm not a prisoner," you know. Like, and it's just that you need to keep the connection. He just, no, not a prisoner.
No, the prisoner stays. No, the prisoner doesn't come back, does he? Actually, because actually, if he came back, it would all end, really. So there's a way in which, so it's the continual process, the descent and ascent, and sort of. And
is this sort of place where Merlin gets laughed at and says, "Now that person's going to die."
Yes. Well, he's brought something up, isn't he, from the depths, and sort of, and then the other part, if you like, the part of the surface world in that story, laughs at him and thinks it's ridiculous because he's bringing back paradoxical things. Yeah, and there is something always, and I think that's an important point, Robert Zomers, because there is something about that when you bring up something from the depth, until it travels properly into the known surface world, it often doesn't make sense. So you have an idea out of somewhere, or you find purple headquarters, Becky.
Yeah, I was just thinking about that story, and I was thinking about the cat bringing in dead things as
yeah,
well.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I learnt the other day that if I really congratulate it, it'll bring in less.
that's interesting. That's completely opposite, isn't
opposite
it?
Opposite way of thinking.
Right.
And then I was just thinking, so he goes and he gathers things from the other world that I wouldn't normally see and then brings them into my house.
Yeah.
So suddenly I come face to face with animals that I would normally never see but all exist.
Yeah.
And I was just interested in that, the purpose of animals in being able to bring things into our world.
That's right.
Give us those experiences.
Yes. And there's something interesting there then about really appreciating that. If you really appreciate that and praise the cat,
they
don't do it so much. There's something that's interesting, isn't it? There's something about meeting them.
If you show real gratitude to the rain, I have been truly appreciative, grateful for all sorts of rain in the wrong place.
Yeah.
This is frequently responded.
Yeah.
How much do I have to do?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah,
yes, exactly.
What do you want?
That's right. That's right. And of course, the whole point about this is about relationship, right? That's really what we're looking at in all these things. We're looking at creating relationship between different places all the time, and finding the right ways to connect into this.
No one's ever seen a sealer cat. No one's ever seen a live worm. Because they catch them and try and bring them up, they die. Because of the pressure, they can't live in this cat.
Yes, that's right.
That's right. No one's ever seen a live sealer cat. They're fish that live in the...
They live in a really deep part of the ocean.
And they've got arms like baby hands.
Yeah.
So I'm interested in disorientation.
Yeah. Good.
So it's a question.
See, that's an interesting thing to be interested in.
Disoriented questions don't quite come out.
Yeah.
I think because partly this is where I am in my own experience right now, but
yeah.
I keep getting, so I was interested in something falling in from the northeast.
Yeah.
And then I kept getting the image of a compass, but the compass just going round
and round. Okay, great. Yeah.
And not sort of in a way, something about that. And so I was curious about what you were saying about coming from the deep, the depth, and it's almost like getting the bends.
Well, that's sort of right in a way, because actually partly what happens is in these transitional places there is profound disorientation. That's the 90-degree shift to one level, and there's of course another, to continue this metaphor, if you go into the real deep places of the ocean, then and go into real depth, then there's all kinds of ways in which you have to do that, because it's dangerous to go into the real depths, and it is, one of the things about this whole area is that there are places, if you like, where you learn to operate, and then you come to another layer, another deep, and then there's disorientation, because special adaptations have to happen to enable you. So very often, that sense of disorientation can be because you're breaking through into a new place, but it never feels, real breakthrough, I think, is never very comfortable. It's not some blissful experience. It normally is a very disorientating experience in which you often feel like being a baby again, where you're kind of having to relearn things and do yourself differently and feel all that clumsiness and what the hell I'm doing this, until of course you learn to operate in the new environment, by which time your identity is expanded and shifted again somewhere. Anyway, that's yeah.
And not being
where you expect it to be. No, that's right, exactly.
And just having to kind of
Yeah, and having to literally reorientate from that, but reorientating from a new place, of course, because you can't rely on the old kind of reflexes, And I think there's certainly something of that image of the spinning wheel and things falling out of it, and particularly falling out of the northeast, because the northeast is the place where the cycle rejoins itself.
Yeah.
So something falling over at that place suggests the breaking of an old cycle or the breaking of a cycle, mm-hmm. and there's and at least for right now, just in terms of those images, there's no clear place to orientate around, because actually it's just doing that. And so the only thing that you can do when you're in circumstances like that is to find orientation in the movement, in the disorientation. That's the paradox of relaxing into the disorientation, and from there you can then start to find yourself in a different way.
That feels a lot like what's been going on when our two groups have got together.
Yeah, totally. Mm-hmm. Completely, yeah. Different ways, different methods, different structures, different shapes, right? And in some ways what we were looking at this morning, and you've all years, in a sense, have been dealing with these differences and then looking at it together and reflecting together this morning is a bit like the creation of a new kind of orientation by things being able to become articulated in a different way. Yeah, very much so. So it happens all kinds of different levels, this process.
Just about the bends, sorry, obviously this is the last backdoor of Ben, I know. I was just reading about how whales go, for some reason, going down, they can go down 2 kilometres.
Mm.
And how whales go down, and because they eat squid, and they found them at the bottom. Mm. And the reason they can go down, and because of the problem with the bends, they shut down their lungs, they shut down the
alveoli,
they
yeah.
shut them down. And so the oxygen that they go with is in the muscles.
Yeah.
The muscles can store huge amounts of oxygen. Mm. And so it's muscles, not lungs.
That's right. No, that's right, and that's a really good image. So as you go into real deep places, almost you have to become like a whale. So it means you have to shut down. When it's very powerful, and it's such a powerful metaphor, that, isn't it? Because you have to shut down your normal way of staying alive. You can't hold oxygen in your lungs at those depths, because actually your lungs would rupture. And so the lungs are collapsed. And somewhere that which keeps you alive is more deeply in the structure of your body somewhere.
That's all Siobhan needed to do, just say with her dolphins.
What was that? Just stop breathing?
Shut down your lungs.
Oh no, there were sharks. There was a shark
issue. There was a shark issue arising there.
So how's that related back to our practice? Because we still always have that awareness of the surface. No matter how deep we get, or do we?
No, we don't. Right, that's the other piece, right? So there's a certain level when you go into the really deep places where you have to let go of that place altogether, yeah. Right? And on the surface, being aware of your sense on the surface, right? So, and this is a place where you could say that traditionally you talk about the sense of losing the sense of self,
yeah.
Right? So that sense of, up until this point, here's me, even an altered me, exploring something mysterious. There's a place then where that goes, and even my sense of self goes,
yeah.
And so I am this being then who goes down into the depths. And I won't recover my sense of self actually until I'm much further up again and away from that experience. So normally that's an even deeper kind of process somewhere where you go then deeply into the non-dual, if we were to use that language, right? Where you just sort of, and there's no witness. There's no witness in that place either. That's the other key thing.
Is the
increasingly less and less. It starts off there, of course, because we start at the surface, right, and I start with a sense of here's me descending into holding a question or with an inquiry. Now the very first thing I have to do is to become one with that question in a deeper way, which is, it means I have to give over at least some control into the question itself and into the body. And as we descend, less and less we're in control. Something else is in control. And then in this whale image, where we're now in that deeper place, we completely lose control and directionality. We lose all that. And we give ourselves then into, then that's a place where you really do give your, well, so something is given into the deep. Something dies and something returns.
Yes.
This is the bit in the poem where it talks about none but seven return from.
Yeah.
Right, because actually something then is really let go of, to go into the very deep places where you can find the delicious squid.
Yeah.
You have to die. You have to you have to completely let go of the capacity to breathe. You know, that's why that's always been such a great image with whales, because it is literally you stop breathing.
Yeah.
There are different levels of profundity for this, aren't there? Because when you're meditating, there can be a moment, there can be a shift that's and suddenly it starts doing you. And you're still quite present, but it is doing you.
Yeah, that's right.
And then there can be more profound shifts, and it's still the same kind of thing of it being more than you. But it can be. It can happen at a more...
Yeah, it happens in lots of layers, right? So again, remember this glyph where there's lots of layers to this, so there's lots of... But the thing that's particularly identifiable in this is the absence of... In this shift is the absence of witness. There isn't a sense of you. Mm-hmm. That goes completely. So there's... Wherever... You know, because you can be on the edges of this, feeling it very close to that non-dual experience, witnessing it in a with very little sense of form self, but that's still there is still a witness presence. There is still a sense of me and it.
Yeah.
This is like a total unification with whatever it is.
Never mind.
It's a bit like being stoned and thinking, God, that's so profound. And then you go and look at it and you don't think, oh, I have no idea what that means.
Yeah, but that's it, right? That's kind of what we're talking about, isn't it? Right? Because in that moment, right? In that moment, you get some. You're with something. You're unified with it, and then you try and talk about it, right? And then that translation problem kicks in, and oh fuck, it's gone. I lost their shit. It's gone.
It was a real moment of that.
That's right.
What can I say about that?
Yeah.
I've just been thinking about the triple death.
Yeah.
And the human sacrifice.
Yeah.
What you have to give up to go to the depths. And as well as not breathing, you have to give up being articulate as well.
Yeah, totally.
You have to give up the three things that are most important.
Yeah.
And the triple death, the human sacrifice, was the metaphor for achieving our descent.
Yeah, that's true. Absolutely. Yeah.
So what were the three?
The triple death is, it's part druidic, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, it's druidic.
Ancient Celtic as well.
Yeah.
There are examples of human sacrifice where the victim supposedly experienced three deaths.
Lindo Man's the classic example. So you find him in the British Museum. So he was garrotted. He was garrotted. He was drowned in a pool and struck with an axe.
Yeah. But I think those are three metaphors.
Yeah.
For what you give up.
Yeah.
Like articulacy.
Yeah.
Another thing, breathing.
Yeah.
The natural things the body would do. You give up. To achieve that depth
and
understanding.
And that everyday sense of consciousness.
Yes.
Yeah, totally. That's right.
So can one say, one always knows when one comes back from that?
You know when you come back, and you come back with something that you can't quite articulate, but just, yeah, I mean, when... Siobhan just did it then actually would easily, right? So you got there, was there, came out, the words are gone, right? And it's what Roberto was talking about as well, that sort of where you come back with this sense of something, and what you know is not quite it. Right, so because in that deep place, you and it are different, and that's why there's all these metaphors in fairy tales. But you come back from the other world, and the precious thing has changed, and you've changed in that process.
It's interesting because in society, what's kind of being noticed now is that sense of what people want. We don't want to buy stuff anymore. What we want is an immersive experience.
Yeah.
So places like John Lewis's and some of these really big stores are looking at how can they give us an immersive experience and make money out of it somehow, but at the same time, we have to be able to leave with something.
Yeah.
And they've been exploring how we might be using virtual reality as a way to have an immersive experience that we wouldn't be able to have anywhere else. So they're almost, these big stores are almost going to become containments for that.
Yeah.
And if you take that on to another level, that's quite interesting. So we've been working with Debenhams quite a bit, looking at what they're thinking about in some of their big stores. And they're thinking about that there may be anything from an experience of being under the sea, and that you would go into that space as a way of feeling relaxed, or it could be something as simple as that. But I'm just sitting here thinking, I wonder what the effect of that will be.
Yes, that's right.
Because you're giving someone an experience, they might have taken it quite lightly. Started like, oh, that sounds like a bit of fun, let's go and do that.
Yeah.
But if we're looking nowadays at selling experiences, part of our person. Well, it's just interesting, isn't it? I bet none of that's been completely thought through on any level.
No, I think that's right.
Potentially, people are going to be experiencing this more and more.
Yes, that's right. And I think even the phrase immersive experience is interesting, isn't it? Because there's something about that sense of immersion and going into depth, you know.
It's always to do with being divorced from nature, isn't it? That you don't have any immersive experiences.
Being divorced from your normal experience, because when going into Iceland is an immersive experience, you're going into, you know.
Yeah, it's true.
Aldi's, you know. How is that not immersive?
Well, the fact is, natural life is immersive. Children playing, which they don't do anymore, that's an immersive experience. People going for walks and experience, you know, being semi-rural, doing their garden, all this sort of, as people retire to their bedrooms and their offices with computers.
Yeah, but what I think Becky is talking about, if I've got it right, is Debenhams and other commercial enterprises are marketing virtual reality.
Yeah.
What we've been talking about, experience, is a real reality or a real unreality, playing with words, but it has a realness for us.
It's authentic.
Whereas what is being marketed is not real.
And it's not ours either, somebody else is imposing it on us.
Yeah. Yes. But what I'm saying is the opportunity for doing that has arisen because people feel deprived of something.
Yes, that's right.
Imaginal and exterior.
Yeah, deeper life, absolutely.
Bring those two together, you've got something very interesting that could happen.
Yes, that's right, exactly. Yeah, totally.
You were to rethink that really well.
Yeah, that's right.
Think it through quite safely.
Yeah. Well, you could do something very powerful, couldn't you? You could do something, use the technology to help people have a very deep experience. You know, there's nothing wrong, you know, there's a, you know, that's right. I mean, that's the possibility of that.
It's somewhere. Now it's red here because it's a commercial enterprise and they want you, us, to buy something.
You probably end up paying for the experience, I think. That's what you're going to have to do, but
yeah.
It kind of didn't seem too bad to me.
Yeah, no, I think obviously if they're doing it to get you to buy a product, that would be kind of form of brainwashing, which wouldn't be so good really, but if they're marketing the immersive experience itself, as long as that experience was designed in the right kind of way, it could be a very powerful thing. It would depend how well it was designed, I suppose.
My mother's doing something in artificial intelligence, and if I ask them what it's about, then I get lost, but it's to do with having a far more immersive experience in museums. He's doing a PhD on it.
That's interesting.
Museum's interested in how to make it far more.
E.M. Forster's story, written back in the 1920s, called Machine Stops, where we each have our own room, which is a total immersive experience. The problem comes when the machine providing all this grinds to a halt, and humanity is less standard, for sure.
But it's reminding me about the conversation we had yesterday about drugs. You know, but it's like having to use something to get to that place. And so the word in immersive, you know, rotation is immersive. You can't go anywhere with it. But so it's interesting, isn't it? It's that thing of using something to get you to a place where.
But you can do this without buying. Unless you're persuaded the only way you can get there is by
well you can't really, because the culture has divorced people from the resources they need to get it naturally.
That's what I'm saying. If you're persuaded you can't do it, then you can buy it. If you caught on to the fact you could do it without buying it, then that would subvert the entire setup.
Yes.
They want us to go to their shops,
I had an interesting experience with alternative reality and being let down when it finished. When I was a child, we used to come in from school every day, and being working class, we had a telly as soon as they were around. And come in, switch on the telly, watch children's programmes.
total immersive experience, tells the riverbank, stuff like that. And then the news came, and there was this clunk of returning to boredom of reality, of being at home and having to do with things and all that sort. And I remember that most distinctly, wanting television to go on and on and on forever.
For Debenhams or any other virtual reality to work, you've got to ensure boredom is paramount, otherwise people wouldn't bother.
Well, no, it's not their job to ensure that, because they are reacting to something that is a reality. Boredom has become paramount. The more we've had, the more bored we've got.
Suggesting the function of the capitalist system is to create boredom to ensure consumerism.
Gotcha, yeah.
Yeah, that's the engine.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Just back on the whales, but they have the squid are delicious, and that's why they're down there. But some of the squid are really big, and when they have it's not actually a foregone conclusion. They can't see when they're down there. They can hear.
Yeah.
But it is a battle. They're at sort of the end of their oxygen, but it's not grazing. It is a battle. And a lot of that's why big whales have sort of like get scars. They come back, bring back sometimes as squid and sometimes badly scarred.
Yeah.
And I just thought that was just.
Well, that's a really useful image as well, because
very
actually.
Dark and very, very deep.
That's right, because actually at that deep level, if you like, of the kind of universal psyche, that here be dragons, actually, because you touched then into very powerful energies that can harm as well as bless, right? So one of the things that happens as you become accustomed to this kind of work and as you become accustomed to, if you like, this deeper kind of element, you of course realize it's not just subjective, it's not just contained within your psyche. Your psyche is contained within this larger life. Mm-hmm. And you have a larger identity in that, but also you encounter energies that are real, you know. So you could encounter, for example, John's image of the capitalist, you could encounter the spirit of capitalism. Okay, as an actual living entity, you know, which I personally wouldn't like to meet head on. I think it would be very difficult, you know. So this, you could also, of course, meet a deep and creative goddess, whatever that is, right? A source of life and light. But the thing is, the thing that's important at that level is it's not the surface you that can even go there, right? So it's the deeper identity. So what happens, I think, as we do this over and over again, is that our sense of identity kind of shifts. We become, in a sense, what I called it yesterday, sort of a living cell within the universe. We have this deeper identity that our surface mind is just a little part of. And if you like, that part of us has its own life, its own directionality, and as we sort of unify with that, we find ourselves, what we're really doing is linking up all these layers, and we find ourselves able to have access to, but therefore be access to, by other aspects of existence. So learning how to do that safely, learning how to contain, how to do that in a way that we can contain the inevitable disruptions and disorientations and maintain this sense of connected integrity, is a large part of what the work actually is. And I'm just going to finish off on this, and we're going to have a brief tea break. All these images of sea and moon and things are really kind of interesting, really, and reminded me about my heroine Dionne Fortran. Because one of her myths, which was to do with the myth of Atlantis, was that she has this, and it's relevant in a way to the kind of the political situation we're talking about, where she had this sort of root myth, really, of this continent where you have this very powerful priesthood, male priesthood organized around the sun, the worship of the sun. And then she imagined that there was a small island with with another kind of priesthood who are dedicated to the worship of the sea, the moon and the stars. And the in her myth, the sun priests become a sort of tamper with the energies of the earth, try to control the energies of the earth, try and channel the energies of the earth, and effectively create a great explosion which destroys the lost continent of Atlantis. And before the before this happens, the priesthood of the sea and the stars send out people who can be seed bearers, who can bring the seeds of a different way of being into the world, which is about being able to work with the moon and the sea and the stars. And in a way, that myth has a lot of relevance to the things that we're talking about. Whether it literally happened or not, it probably never did. But I mean, it's probably a myth based around the eruption of the Santorini volcano, really. But the myth is important. The images are important because in that way, because they're like, there are these two competing realities at the moment somewhere. There are this kind of desire to control the world, destroy the world, power the world. Humanity is as the absolute men. Emphasis on male as the absolute ruler of things, as opposed to this other way of being, which actually is deeper, but gets overshadowed by the brightness and the kind of and the in-your-faceness of the kind of the solar image somewhere.
It's similar to the story of Avalokita Javara when his head explodes.
Yeah, that's right.
He has to get. Process.
Totally, and so something has to go right back to the beginning. So there's this explosion, things get destroyed. You have to return to the beginning of things, and then rebuild in a different way.
A thousand times.
Yeah, in his case, he has to rebuild his body. In the Atlantis story, you go right back to the beginning, right back to the beginnings of existence, and all the old wisdom of Atlantis is lost. But it gets rebuilt in a different way. Okay, let's leave it there. Let's have a cup of tea.
What about Rinpoche?